It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock today. Our critics review the new Netflix film Extraction, the action flick starring Chris Hemsworth, and the HBO original film that premieres tomorrow night, Bad Education, stars Hugh Jackman and Allison Janney. Those and more films coming up at 11 o'clock, Film Week on KPCC. And then that follows at noon with Governor Gavin Newsom's daily news conference with the latest on the state efforts to control COVID-19. But we check in for our daily update on the coronavirus, as well as public health experts. And with us is Professor Robert Kim Farley, UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. He was director of the Division of Communicable Disease Control and Prevention for Los Angeles County's Department of Public Health up until just a couple of years ago, and former senior official with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization. Professor Kim Farley, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
Larry, it's good to be back again. And as one of your guests on the COVID series and also an avid listener myself, I just want to offer congratulations on your 31st anniversary of hosting Air Talk this month.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Very nice. Let's start with, first of all, some interesting news out of Oxford University, where they're beginning a phase one trial of a vaccine that the lead researcher says she feels pretty confident about, and that potentially they could have that vaccine available by September. Now, we've been taught to always be, you know, very conservative about these things and not get too high or too low. But your thoughts about this Oxford study and the first phase of the study?
Yes, thank you. Actually, the Oxford study, as well as several other vaccine candidates, are entering phase one trials, which is very encouraging. But these are usually small numbers of cases, maybe about 50 persons that are being entered into these trials just to make sure that the vaccine is safe. Then you'll actually have to go to a phase two trial, which would be several hundred people, volunteers, that looks more at the issue of not only safety but efficacy. And then you have to go to phase three, which would be thousands of people, to really see the results. And then finally, once you have a vaccine that is both safe and effective, you have to be able to gear up from production at the manufacturing level to make millions upon millions of doses. So those are the reasons why, yeah, you may have a candidate vaccine by that time, but to be able to actually have it ready to go for mass production is a different issue.
This process, they apparently took an adenovirus, which I guess like common cold, from chimpanzees and then adapted it for humans. And from what you know, are the other trials looking at something similar, or are they looking at other types of viruses?
Yeah, they're actually looking at other things, from the issue of just being able to take out certain pieces of this virus that would not be infective in themselves, but that the body would recognize as being something different and develop antibody towards it. So there's lots of different ways of if you will, attenuated vaccines or killed vaccines approaches that are being done. So there's lots of different opportunities to skin this cat, so to speak. And we'll see which
one. Why is it easier to develop some vaccines? Like, you know, we have our seasonal flu vaccine, which is updated with different strains every year. We still don't have a vaccine for HIV. What is it that makes certain viruses easier to deal with, to vaccinate against?
Larry, that's a very good question. And a lot of it has to do with how much mutation occurs with the virus, to be able to find those pieces of the virus, if you will, that don't mutate and can be challenging. Because otherwise you develop a vaccine, you have to change it. That's actually what we have to do each year with influenza vaccine. But we've got that procedure down. We know about influenza vaccines. It's pretty easy to make a vaccine from the currently circulating strains and then be able to go to mass production for that. But even that still takes 6 months to produce all the vaccines necessary because it's grown in eggs, and it takes time to build that up. There's new technologies that we're trying to do to speed this process.
We're talking with UCLA Fielding School of Public Health professor Dr. Bob Kim Farley, who's joined us throughout the course of COVID-19 to provide his expertise. If you have questions for him, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. You can also ask your question on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, or you can tweet at AirTalk or post a message to the AirTalk Facebook page with your question about COVID-19. Today we got an FDA warning about a couple of malarial drugs that have been used to treat COVID-19 patients. Anecdotally, there were stories that it was helpful, at least some physicians thought, in some of these cases, but the FDA now saying they should not be used for COVID patients. Explain for us how they would have reached that conclusion, despite some of the anecdotal accounts of it being beneficial.
Yes, thanks, Larry. I think your point you bring up is really important from a science viewpoint, is that anecdotal reports are much different than controlled clinical trials, where you have blinded who gets the placebo, who gets this drug, and to see really what is the efficaciousness of it. And that's what's happening, is that some of these early trials are coming back now on chloroquine, because it looked like it might be promising because it did have some antiviral activity in the test tube, but it's turning out that it doesn't appear to be that promising or efficacious in a human, and because of the fact it does have side effects. I mean, there are some effects on the heart that chloroquine can have in some people. And so the risks actually became even worse than the benefits. And that's why the FDA warning has come out.
All right. And from your standpoint, you think that makes sense? And will there still be physicians who you expect will prescribe it to patients who have COVID-19? And are they free to do that despite the FDA warning?
I think this would certainly be a very red flag for physicians that were considering the possible use of chloroquine when it was not really known, and we had these anecdotal reports. I think there were some that were, you know, using that as a way of trying to hope when they've got a very seriously ill patient. But I think with this FDA warning, that will curb the appetite for using something that is, you know, having now demonstrated potential harms, as well as something that is not really seeming to be that efficacious. They'll probably look at other things that are still looking promising. You've got the remdesivir, for example, and other, you know, the convalescent plasma you've been hearing about. These are things that I think still hold some promise, but even those are still undergoing clinical trials.
I wanted to ask you about the antibody studies. There are three major ones we've heard a lot about: Santa Clara County up in the Bay Area from Stanford, USC study here in Los Angeles County, and the one in New York, actually one the state's doing, and New York City is also launching their antibody study. But we see that based on the early results in New York, the conclusion that potentially one in five people have the antibody. Now, are you at all skeptical of that result, or do you think that that could be accurate?
No, I'm not that skeptical, Larry. I think that the more we're learning about how much asymptomatic spread without having symptoms, is occurring, and the fact that they have been so heavily hit in New York, you know, when you see the numbers of cases and deaths that they've had. And in Los Angeles, you know, again, we're looking about maybe 4.1% of adults having antibodies, and that translates with the margin of error to between 221,000 to 442,000 Angelenos also already having had the virus and recovered from it and have antibody with it now, which is, you know, a lot of asymptomatic spread.
We're talking with UCLA Fielding School of Public Health professor Dr. Bob Kim Farley. He was the director of the Division of Communicable Disease Control and Prevention for LA County Department of Public Health for more than a decade, right up until a couple of years ago, and has been a senior official with Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. Harold in West Los Angeles says, do we know what degree of mutation the virus has undergone?
Yes, thank you, Harold. This virus does undergo mutation. It appears to be relatively gradual mutations as compared to something, you know, vastly different every time it comes through a person. But I think what's very important is to realize that the nature of this coronavirus is to be able to mutate. So that's one thing we have to always keep in mind. You know, will this become more contagious, less contagious? Will it become more severe, less severe? If you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, it's to the virus's advantage to become more contagious and less deadly. So that because it doesn't help the virus if the host is killed, because it then doesn't transmit further. So we could hope that that might be the case, but you know, we will just have to see over time how does this new virus that we've never seen before actually behave.
Given, you know, back to the antibody study in New York, does this lead you to the conclusion that COVID-19 is more infectious, it's more communicable than we had earlier thought because of the asymptomatic individuals, but less lethal than we had thought? And I say that knowing full well the huge death toll it's already taken.
Yes, Larry, that's an astute observation. And again, I'm with you in my heart going out to the tragic loss of now over 50,000 people in the United States. We just passed that milestone, tragic milestone today. But you are correct that this means that it looks like that this virus is more contagious than originally felt because of the fact that it looks like that those who are symptomatic are just the tip of the iceberg, if you will, of something much larger going on underneath that. I think that also is going to make it more challenging for a contact tracing effort. We certainly need to have very strong and robust testing. We need to have enough testing so that anyone who has any symptoms can be tested, and those who then test positive are isolated and close contacts are quarantined. But we also have to realize that for every case that we'll be identifying, there may be other cases that we will have no symptoms at all, and we will not know. And I think that's one of the reasons why we'll start, as we get, again, more aggressive testing and available testing, to, for example, in high-risk areas like nursing homes, for example, to just be testing everyone to make sure that if the virus is there, that we're taking appropriate actions and to make sure that people are not bringing virus and starting up something in a very high-risk area where people are elderly, have multiple medical conditions, and are likely, if have virus, to have serious disease.
How close do you think we are to that? I know in Los Angeles, we now have the testing of frontline medical people who are asymptomatic, able to get that. But to what you're talking about, universal nursing home testing of everybody and keeping that up over time.
I think we're, you know, close to getting enough testing for doing the targeted testing that we need, and I'm very pleased that we were getting enough testing to also start looking at what is the pattern in the society itself on a statistically valid representative sample of the population. But I think we're still a ways away from being able to have all the testing that we really need for people that have even mild symptoms to be able to be tested. And it's not just the number of test kits. It's also the issue of staffing in laboratories. It's also the swabs, the other ancillary things that are surrounding testing. So all of these things are still somewhat bottlenecks.
A final question, as we are in the midst of a heat wave, I believe today is supposed to be the hottest day, but we've got a very warm weekend to come. There are concerns that many people are going to go to the beaches, particularly in Orange and Ventura counties, where the beaches are available for people to go. L.A. County beaches are shut down. For those who are going to go to the beach where it is legal and open to do so, what warnings would you give them?
Yes, I think it's important that just as we are doing in any other place that is around, from walking on our streets, et cetera, really to practice the physical distancing. That even at your beach, fine, you know, you, with your own immediate nuclear household family or the people you're living with, fine, you can be clustered together, have your picnic, but not be with other large groups. And so I think that's the real key here as we begin to have some gradual, nuanced, very tailored approaches to being able to relaxing some physical distancing measures, to realize that we need to still be doing the face covering, things like this, when we are in stores and when we're going out, even on a beach, we need to be keeping that physical distancing.
Bob, I can't thank you enough. Really appreciate your joining us today. And stay healthy and safe and have a good weekend. Thank you.
Stay well yourself, Larry, and again, congratulations on the 35th anniversary.
Appreciate it so much. That's Dr. Robert Kim Farley, professor, UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, joining us on Air Talk and taking your questions. Coming up, I want to talk with Air Talk listeners who are in recovery. What are the ways that you're adapting to the limitations on in-person meetings? That's one of the fundamental parts of recovery, is being able to go to meetings, share with other individuals how your sobriety is going, or your path to sobriety. How are you adapting to that, and is technology helping to fill that need? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, back in 90 seconds.